Chapter 29. It was not yet dawn, and he willed, and one who was lying in his cell in the convent of Jacobins, awake and shuddering with terror for a crime which he had committed, fell asleep. But though he was asleep, his eyes were open. And after tossing and writhing, and clinging to the pallet, and saying, "No, I will not go," he rose up, and donned his clothes, a gray coat, a vest of white pique, black satin small clothes, ribbed silk stockings, and a white stock with a steel buckle, and he arranged his hair, and he tied his queue, all the while being in that strange somnolence which walks, which moves, which flies sometimes, which sees, which is indifferent to pain, which obeys. And he put on his hat, and he went forth from his cell, and though the dawn was not yet, he trod the corridors as seeing them. And he passed into the cloister, and then into the garden, where lie the ancient dead. And he came to the wicket, which Brother Jerome was opening just at the dawning. And the crowd was already waiting with their cans and bowls to receive the alms of the good brethren. And he passed through the crowd, and went on his way, and the few people then abroad who marked him, said, "Teens, how very odd he looks. He looks like a man walking in his sleep." This was said by various persons. By milk women, with their cans and carts, coming into the town. By roisterers who had been drinking at the taverns of the barrier, for it was mid-Lent. By the sergeants of the watch, who eyed him sternly as he passed near their halberds. But he passed on unmoved by their halberds, unmoved by the cries of the roisterers, by the market women coming with their milk and eggs. He walked through the Rue Saint-Honoré, I say. By the Rue Rambuteau, by the Rue Saint-Antoine, by the King's Chateau of the Bastille, by the Faubourg Saint-Antoine. And he came to number 29 in the Rue Picpusset house which then stood between a court and garden, that is, there was a building of one story, with a great coach door. Then there was a court, around which were stables, coach houses, offices. Then there was a house, a two-storied house, with a perron in front. Behind the house, was a garden of 250 French feet in length. And as 100 feet of France equal 106 feet of England, this garden, my friends, equaled exactly 265 feet of British measure. In the center of the garden, was a fountain and a statue, or, to speak more correctly, two statues. One was recumbent, a man. Over him, saber in hand, stood a woman. The man was Oliphants. The woman was Judith. From the head, from the trunk, the water gushed. It was the taste of the doctor. Was it not a droll of taste? At the end of the garden, was the doctor's cabinet of study. My faith, a singular cabinet, and singular pictures. Decapitation of Charles Premier at Vidal. Decapitation of Montrose at Edinburgh. Decapitation of Cinq-Mars. When I tell you that he was a man of a taste, charming. Through this garden, by these statues, up these stairs, went the pale figure of him who, the porter said, knew the way of the house. He did. Turning neither right nor left, he seemed to walk through the statues, the obstacles, the flower beds, the stairs, the door, the tables, the chairs. In the corner of the room was that instrument, which Guillotin had just invented and perfected. One day he was to lay his own head under his own axe. Peace be to his name. With him I deal not. In a frame of mahogany, neatly worked, was a board with a half circle in it, over which another board fitted. Above was a heavy axe, which fell you know how. It was held up by a rope, and when this rope was untied, or cut, the steel fell. To the story which I now have to relate, you may give credence, or not, as you will. The sleeping man went up to that instrument. He laid his head in it, asleep. Asleep? He then took a little penknife out of the pocket of his white dimity waistcoat. He cut the rope asleep. The axe descended on the head of the traitor and villain. The notch in it was made by the steel buckle of his stock, which was cut through. A strange legend has got abroad, that after the deed was done, the figure rose, took took the head from the basket, walked forth through the garden, and by the screaming porters at the gate, and went and laid itself down at the morgue. But for this, I will not vouch. Only of this be sure. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamed of in your philosophy. Apostrophe, apostrophe, more and more the light peeps through the chinks. Soon, amidst music ravishing, the curtain will rise, and the glorious scene be displayed. Adieu. Remember me. Ha! 'Tis dawn, Pinto said. And he was gone. I am ashamed to say that my first movement was to clutch the check which he had left with me, and which I was determined to present the very moment the bank opened. I know the importance of these things, and that men change their minds sometimes. I sprang through the streets to the great banking house of Manasseh in Duke Street. It seemed to me as if I actually flew as I walked. As the clock struck 10, I was at the counter and laid down my check. The gentleman who received it, who was one of the Hebrew persuasion, as were the other 200 clerks of the establishment, having looked at the draft with terror in his countenance, then looked at me, then called to himself two of his fellow clerks, and queer it was to see all their aquiline beaks over the paper. Come, come, said I, don't keep me here all day. Hand me over the money, short, if you please. For I was, you see, a little alarmed, and so determined to assume some extra bluster. Will you have the kindness to step into the parlor to the partners? The clerk said, and I followed him. What, again? Shrieked a bald-headed, red-whiskered gentleman, whom I knew to be Mr. Manasseh. Mr. Salathiel, this is too bad. Leave me with this gentleman, S. And the clerk disappeared. Sir, he said, I know how you came by this. The Count de Pinto gave it you. It is too bad. I honor my parents. I honor their parents. I honor their bills. But this one of Grandma's is too bad it is, upon my word now. She've been dead these 35 years. And this last 4 months as he has left her burial place, and took to drawing on our house. It's too bad, Grandma. It is too bad. And he appealed to me, and tears actually trickled down his nose. Is it the Countess Sidonia's check or not? I asked, haughtily. But, I tell you, she's dead. It's a shame. It's a shame. It is, Grandmama. And he cried, and wiped his great nose in his yellow pocket handkerchief. Look here, will you take pounds instead of guineas? She's dead, I tell you. It's no go. Take the pounds, one toss and pound, 10 nice, neat, crisp 100-pound notes, and go away with you, do. I will have my bond, sir, or nothing, I said, and I put on an attitude of resolution which I confess surprised even myself. Worry well, he shrieked, with many oaths, then you shall have noting, ha, 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 noting but a policeman. Mr. Abednego, call a policeman. Take that, you humbug and impostor. And here, with an abundance of frightful language which I dare not repeat, the wealthy banker abused and defied me. About Duke Comte, what was I to do, if a banker did not choose to honor a check drawn by his dead grandmother? I began to wish I had my snuff box back. I began to think I was a fool for changing that little old-fashioned gold for this slip of strange paper. Meanwhile the banker had passed from his fit of anger to a paroxysm of despair. He seemed to be addressing some person invisible, but in the room, colon, look here, ma'am, you've really been coming it too strong. 100,000 in 6 months, and now 1,000 more. The house can't stand it. It won't stand it, I say. What? Oh! Mercy, mercy! As he uttered these words, a hand fluttered over the table in the air. It was a female hand. That which I had seen the night before. That female hand took a pen from the green baize table, dipped it in a silver inkstand, and wrote on a quarter of a sheet of foolscap on the blotting book, how about the diamond robbery? If you do not pay, I will tell him where they are. What diamonds? What robbery? What was this mystery? That will never be ascertained, for the wretched man's demeanor instantly changed. Certainly, sir. Oh, certainly, he said, forcing a grin. Ah, will you have the money, sir? All right, Mr. Abednego. This way out. I hope I shall often see you again, I said, on which I own poor Manasseh gave a dreadful grin, and shot back into his parlor. I ran home, clutching the 10 delicious, crisp £100, and the dear little 50 which made up the account. I flew through the streets again. I got to my chambers. I bolted the outer doors. I sank back in my great chair, and slept. My first thing on waking, was to feel for my money. Perdition! Where was I? Ha! On the table before me was my grandmother's snuff box, and by its side one of those admirable sensation novels, which I had been reading, and which are full of delicious wonder. But that the guillotine is still, to be seen at Mr. Gale's, number 47 High Holborn, I give you my honor. I suppose I was dreaming about it. I don't know. What is dreaming? What is life? Why shouldn't I sleep on the ceiling? And am I sitting on it now, or on the floor? I am puzzled. But enough. If the fashion for sensation novels goes on, I tell you I will write one in 50 volumes. For the present, Dixie. But between ourselves, this Pinto, who fought at the Colosseum, who was nearly being roasted by the Inquisition, and sang duets at Holyrood, I am rather sorry to lose him after three little bits of roundabout papers. Et vous? Definibus. When Swift was in love with Stella, and dispatching her a letter from London thrice a month by the Irish packet, you may remember how he would begin letter no. XXIII. We will say, on the very day, when XXII had been sent away, stealing out of the coffee house or the assembly so as to be able to prattle with his dear, never letting go her kind hand, as it were, as some commentator or other has said, in speaking of the dean and his amour. When Mr. Johnson, walking to Dodsley's, and touching the posts in Pall Mall as he walked, forgot to pat the head of one of them, he went back, and imposed his hands on it, impelled I know not by what superstition. I have this, I hope not dangerous mania to. As soon as a piece of work is out of hand, and before going to sleep, I like to begin another. It may be, to write only half a dozen lines. But that is something towards number the next. The printer's boy has not yet reached Green Arbor Court with the copy. Those people who were alive half an hour since, Pendennis, Clive Newcomb, and what do you call him? What was the name of the last hero? I remember now. Philip Furman, have hardly drunk their glass of wine, and the mamas have only this minute got the children's cloaks on, and have been bowed out of my premises, and here I come back to the study again. Tamanus Cricuro. How lonely it looks now all these people are gone. My dear good friends, some folks are utterly tired of you, and say, what a poverty of friends the man has. He is always asking us to meet those Pendennises, Newcombs, and so forth. Why does he not introduce us to some new characters? Why is he not thrilling like two stars, learned and profound like three stars, exquisitely humorous and human like four stars? Why, finally, is he not somebody else? My good people, it is not only impossible to please you all, but it is absurd to try. The dish which one man devours, another dislikes. Is the dinner of today not to your taste? Let us hope tomorrow's entertainment will be more agreeable. I resume my original subject. What an odd, pleasant, humorous, melancholy feeling it is to sit in the study, alone and quiet, now all these people are gone who have been boarding and lodging with me for 20 months. They have interrupted my rest. They have plagued me at all sorts of minutes. They have thrust themselves upon me when I was ill, or wished to be idle, and I have growled out a hang to you, can't you leave me alone now? Once or twice they have prevented my going out to dinner. Many and many a time they have prevented my coming home, because I knew they were there waiting in the study, and a plague take them. And I have left home and family, and gone to dine at the club, and told nobody where I went. They have bored me, those people. They have plagued me at all sorts of uncomfortable hours. They have made such a disturbance in my mind and house, that sometimes I have hardly known what was going on in my family, and scarcely have heard what my neighbor said to me. They are gone at last, and you would expect me to be at ease? Far from it. I should almost be glad if Wilcombe would walk in and talk to me, or Twisden reappear, take his place in that chair opposite me, and begin one of his tremendous stories. Madmen, you know, see visions, hold conversations with, even draw the likeness of, people invisible to you and me. Is this making of people out of fancy madness? And are novel writers at all entitled to straight waistcoats? I often forget people's names in life, and in my own stories contritely own that I make dreadful blunders regarding them. But I declare, my dear sir, with respect to the personages introduced into your humble servant's fables, I know the people utterly. I know the sound of their voices. A gentleman came in to see me the other day, who was so like the picture of Philip Furman in Mr. Walker's charming drawings in the Cornhill magazine, that he was quite a curiosity to me. The same eyes, beard, shoulders, just as you have seen them from month to month. Well, he is not like the Philip Furman in my mind. Asleep in the grave, lies the bold, the generous, the reckless, the tender-hearted creature whom I have made to pass through those adventures which have just been brought to an end. It is years since I heard the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.